I'm Fathery.
This is Dave.
I'm Rachel.
And this is Text Trek.
Engage.
Welcome back aboard the Starship Texas for the 274th installment of the Text Trek podcast. I like 274th because it's 47 backwards and then a 2 thrown in thereafter, I guess.
It fits that this is a flip side of Star Trek.
Yeah.
I suppose so, but
not a mirror universe, but a flip.
But welcome back to the Text Trek podcast, the home of Star Trek fandom from deep in the heart of Texas, where we take a deep look at Star Trek old and new. And tonight we are talking about the 1999 film Galaxy Quest, written by David Howard and Robert Gordon, and directed by Dean Parisot. It's a silent T on the end. Don't say Parasot, y'all. That's wrong. That's incorrect.
I'll see what I can do. This is like an honorary Star Trek movie. People frequently mention it when you have, like, somebody says, oh, what are your favorite Trek, you know, what's your order of your favorite Trek movies?
The famous example was, I guess, was it 2016 at Vegas? But one year, back when Creation was still doing it as, like, an official convention, they voted on the top ranking of the Star Trek films, and Galaxy Quest was ranked number one.
Yeah, you don't want to allow write-in votes on that one if you don't want to be slightly embarrassed.
It's like often when you do votes on the different adaptations of Emma, Clueless always wins.
Mm. But I think that probably most Emma fans or most Jane Austen fans aren't particularly offended by that. Just as I don't think most Star Trek fans are offended by Galaxy Quest being allowed to hang out in our room.
I think there's a special, because everyone, I feel like, well, not now because people know Galaxy Quest. But I feel like there was definitely a thing where people went in being like, this is going to make fun of us. And we're like, oh, no, we're in on the joke. Like,
we come off well. That's kind of what I thought. But I know we've got other stuff to talk about first. We got some business and stuff.
Yes.
Well, just first of all, we do need to thank the Text Trek Patreon supporters. We do appreciate the monthly contributions. It goes a long way to helping us continue to do the weekly live show. So thank you so much. Starfleet Sohel, Kick is Eternal, Crazy Dutchy, Joanne Robertson, John Dog, Geek Filter, Earl Grey Trekkie, Quarks Bar, Stephanie Durantes, Braxton, Chuck A, and our anonymous supporters. We do like to celebrate each month with a monthly Patreon watch party. So our next one will be February 17th. And whatever tier you're able to help out in the Patreon, it will get you into the watch party. You can come in as little as $2 a month. And we're going to be watching a Valentine's Day themed episode, a Voyager one. We're going to watch Someone to Watch Over Me. As Sohel pointed out last week, it's the one where they sing You Are My Sunshine. It's the doctor teaching Seven of Nine giving her lessons on how to date.
It's a very sweet episode. Good for
Valentine's Day. It's really good.
It'll be a new one to me. I may watch it ahead of time so that I can watch the take it in on its own and then have our conversational look at it.
Yeah, because when we do the watch parties, anyone in attendance, anyone in the Patreon, anyone can unmute and join in the conversation. We have a big, fun, collective Text Trek commentary over the episode. Or if you're shy or if you don't feel like talking, you can type in the chat. We have a text chat going as we're watching this, so it tends to be a fun crowd. So that'll be Saturday, February 17th. And there was, we got a date. Speaking of, like, dates, we have a date for the Discovery premiere at South By. Well, I think we now know it'll be on that Monday, right? I think that's March the, I think it might be the 11th.
What's funny is I've had a couple people who don't understand how expensive South By is. Like, oh, you're going to try and go? And I was like, I don't think you understand.
It's gonna, price. Even people who have, like, the pass, it's going to be, unless you have, like, the silver one, it's going to be hard to,
yeah.
I think that's going to be like mainly like press people or whoever, like if they like allow like, you know, Paramount to bring in X number of people. But I'm we'll look into possibly attending. We'll see. But what's more exciting, I think, for most people is the premiere of the show dropping on Paramount Plus April 4th.
Yes. Yeah, that is probably when most of us will get around to it.
Very much so.
We'll be covering that on Text Trek every week, and we'll bring back the other Thursday night first reaction streams as well.
Yeah, looking forward to getting back to that. It's fun because I like haven't got to do that with Discovery yet, obviously.
Oh yeah, that'll be cool. Mm-hmm. And this is going to be a kind of a heartfelt final season for, you know, as we've talked about before, because mm-hmm. Discovery was kind of what prompted Text Trek to form up. So we'll go on one last ride with this crew.
Yeah, and we'll be doing some stuff kind of leading up to the premiere of the final season in March. So make sure that you are following Text Trek, that you're subscribed, that you can subscribe to the YouTube channel, you can rate the podcast, you can do both. That will really help us out. Oh, I want to thank people. I was saying last week how like I really wanted some people to give us some 5-star reviews on Spotify and get us. We were at 4.2, and I feel like we should never be below 4.7. It should always be above 4.7. And after I said that, it got bumped up to 4.3. So it's kind of a good news, bad news. It's like the bad news is it's still not at 4.7, but the good news is it has moved. So maybe if I reiterate like how important that is to me, it would just mean the world to me if we got that above a 4.7 on Spotify. If anyone listening or watching me right now, if you could open Spotify on your mobile device, look up Text Trek and give it that 5-star rating, I would really appreciate it. Then next week I can be like, look, it moved up again. So let's keep that trend going.
Yeah, I like it.
And with the subscriptions, I think it'd be fun if we hit 1701 on YouTube this year. So,
by the way,
that
Father,
make that happen.
That slow upward tick will be like in Enterprise when they're getting up to warp 5 stars. Where we'll be like, we're at 4.3, 4.4.
No. That's why it stops at 5, because if we went over that, the reactor would explode. And we don't want that, so don't stress out Trip Tucker, but we'll get it up above 4.7, maybe we'll get it all the way up to a perfect 5 someday, but that's the goal.
We'll have to take out some enemies first, Romulan style.
Well, or just take the Tim Allen approach to dealing with Sarah. So, just fire everything, that'll take care of old lobster heads. to be fair, it almost worked, but yeah, I guess we should talk about this movie.
Yeah.
Were you saying, Rachel?
No, I was like, to be fair, that's probably what I would do, too. I was like, I don't know.
Yeah. It's not like they gave him a lot of parameters or instructions.
Like, you're trying to play Street Fighter on the arcade machine. Like, you're not going to, like, look up all, like, how to do all the combos, right? If you don't know what you're doing, you're just going to, I'm just going to hit everything. Why not?
As someone who's an avid button smasher.
Unapologetically, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes it works. Sometimes you win that way.
Yeah. So,
that's true, and it's cheap, but it's also what I do.
Honestly, problem is switching between different systems is half the time I'm like, half the time I'm button smashing to be like, which button is up on the system? I don't know.
Right.
Well, Galaxy Quest, the story of this movie, how it got started, it's kind of interesting. I didn't really know a ton of the behind the scenes until lately, but I kind of just poked around just to see the kind of the surface level stuff. I didn't dig in too deep, but I guess the genesis of Galaxy Quest, it was originally thought up by the writer David Howard, had the idea, and he sold it, and it got changed a little bit, but kind of the basic idea of like this sci-fi TV show got like really popular with these aliens and shenanigans ensue.
Oh, I was going to say, I rewatched the documentary Never Surrender, so I was like, I might just have some weird fun facts that I picked up.
Yeah, you should explain, like, people who don't know that, because it's kind of a unique documentary. But
yeah, it's called Never Surrender. It's about like the making of Galaxy Quest and like how it became like a cult classic. And it's done by Screen Junkies, which is the company that owns like Honest Trailers and like Fandom, like the wiki website.
Yeah.
And so it's clearly done by people who appreciate fan culture. So it's very a loving homage to something that was like a loving homage to fans.
Nice. So it reflects Galaxy Quest itself.
Yeah. And yeah, there's some really fun behind the scenes. They have a lot of the behind the scenes people and most of the actors. I was like a little surprised they got Rainn Wilson to come talk about it, considering how little Rainn Wilson's in the movie.
Oh, yeah. He's one of the, Thermians.
Yeah. It's just like they mentioned, is apparently his role was supposed to be bigger and then he got like a pilot. And so
he's gone on to do okay for himself.
Yeah,
I guess.
I think Rainn Wilson is fine.
Yeah, one of the top five biggest careers in this movie, probably.
Yeah. It's an amazing cast. Like, even, like I don't think Sam Rockwell was, like, a huge name when he did this movie either.
No, yeah. This and The Green Mile both came out in 99.
Yeah.
That was, I guess, like, kind of, both were kind of breakout roles for him.
Yeah, I guess Tim Allen and Alan Rickman were kind of the anchors.
Yeah.
Sigourney Weaver. Alan Rickman really, like, the only thing I really knew him from was, like, Die Hard, and then, like, he showed up as, like, a bad guy in a bunch of movies after that.
Yeah, because this is someone who was genuinely obsessed with Alan Rickman in high school. It was a weird child. I don't know. Alan Rickman's first movie is Die Hard. He didn't get famous till later in life.
Yeah, and then he was just always, like, a British bad guy in everything, except he did play an Irishman in Michael Collins, but he was like a bad guy in that. He was like on the side of the British in the one time he didn't play a British character.
Speaking of Austin characters, to be fair, he's German in Die Hard.
He's
one of the love interests in Sense of Sensibility, but it's very, I think they talked about it, it's definitely not comedies before this. Like, it's very serious, doing Shakespearean stuff. Like, a little bit reminds me of, like, Patrick Stewart's career.
Interesting.
Like, very serious, and then all of a sudden he gets this, like, huge thing. In my case, Die Hard, not, like, and then later on in life, even bigger things, but...
Just out of curiosity, like, just basic reactions, like, first of all, you were too young to see it at the theater, Rachel, is that right?
Yeah, yes. I saw it in high school.
You're like a wee baby.
I was already obsessed with Alan Rickman when I watched it.
That's who they were marketing it to. It's funny, because that's actually the, like, part of the problem was that the movie was marketed to children, and they wanted to make it, like, a very, like, safe family movie.
To what they were marketing for, I think I was still even too young. 99, I was born in 93, so in 99, I would have only been, like, 7?
Yeah. Could have theoretically seen it, but yeah, it was probably a little more of a 10 or 12 and up. Father E, did you see it in the theater?
I did not see it in the theater, but I saw it shortly after. I rented the VHS when it came out.
I'm also not remembering, I was living overseas in 99, so that also could have had a factor in this.
Right.
I would have saw it in 2000 because it was a Christmas release. It was in December. A friend of mine was just reminding me the theater that I went to a lot in Pflugerville, Texas, Tinseltown. It had a big rock monster diorama set up in the lobby when this movie was out. But I saw it on VHS and I really liked it at the time. But it wasn't a movie that I ever like watched and rewatched over and over again. And I saw it in the theater in, I think it was like 2016, I guess, was when Alan Rickman passed away. But they did like a screening at our Alamo Drafthouse. It used to be like a cool local Austin thing. I know it's like a big corporate nationwide chain now. But that is where we saw this one. It was at the Drafthouse that Leonard Nimoy peed on at the premiere of Star Trek 09. But not the actual building, because it's
by the way, look it up, because that's, Father, when you say that, it makes it sound like he did something really harsh and terrible, when it was actually kind of weirdly a generous thing to do.
Oh, I was gonna say, I think I saw this at the right age. Like, I was obsessed with Alan Rickman, and then also obviously really into Star Trek. But like, I feel like high school is like a good age for this movie. It's like you're old and like young enough for it to like make an impression on you, but old enough to like get most of the jokes.
So I saw it again at that screening that I just mentioned in 2016, I think. And I was, like, really impressed with it. I was like, man, this movie holds up so well. Like, I was really, like, surprised at the quality of it. Kind of just, like, forgotten. And you know, seeing it as, like, an adult was kind of different than, like, seeing it as a teenager. And I'm sure there's a lot more I was able to appreciate. And then I really didn't see it again after that until just, like, a couple of weeks ago when we three saw it as a group. And then, like, this week I've watched it 4 times. It's more than, like, I've ever seen it. But going forward, I think I do, like, appreciate this movie more just as it is. It's kind of, like, a rare special thing just because that's kind of how it's just existed in my life. It's not like, you know, Ghostbusters where by the time I turned 7, I had the entire movie, you know, memorized inside and out. I knew, like, every scene. So, instead of that,
it's funny you mentioned Ghostbusters because Harold Ramis almost directed this.
Yeah, I'm sure that's why I was, like, making the connection. But you know, what's funny is that Harold Ramis left because he didn't want to work with Tim Allen. And DreamWorks is like, no, you have to do this movie with Tim Allen. And Harold Ramis didn't want to. And to be fair with Harold Ramis, you know, a lot of people say Tim Allen's an asshole. I know a lot of other people say, like, nice things about him, but a lot of people don't like him. And they didn't probably have, like, a lot of confidence until, or some people probably didn't have like a lot of confidence in Tim Allen because he's just kind of like this funny sitcom TV guy. Like, could he actually carry a movie that had like a little bit of like, you know, budget and effort behind it, like Harold Ramis wanted to do? But you know, Tim Allen, however you feel about him, I think he knocks it out the park in this movie. This is like a just such perfect casting.
That's just what like a great role for
him. Rick and our audience just said a jerk, perfect casting. What were you saying, Rachel?
Oh, no, Tim Allen's perfect. No, there were stories about, in the documentary that, like, they, like, didn't not get along, but it was, like, very clear that Alan Rickman and Tim Allen's processes were very different, apparently.
Yeah, yeah, Alan Rickman
like their
was,
characters.
He was, like, cold and standoffish, and people don't know if it was, is he just being kind of a method actor and being, like, this cranky actor, or is he just, like, actually like that?
I think he's like that, right?
It's like a little bit he's like that, and then a little, I think he's just a little more reserved. And then I've always heard, like, when you would get to know him, you'd be like, oh, he's actually really nice, but you, like, you've got to, like, get through a wall to get to that.
Mm-hmm. But outside of Alan Rickman, it sounded like everyone had, like, a lot of fun working on this movie, and, mm-hmm. and Tim Allen was kind of real funny on set. You know, he's always, like, you know, keeping the mood light and keeping people laughing, and spirits were pretty high.
That's good. You know, I want it to be a fun shoot. I want it to embody some of what the movie shows.
And they sounded like they had a lot of faith in it. They're like, man, we're doing something like really good. Like this is gonna be like some dumb kid movie. This can be the next Ghostbusters. Like
they said, they got very little supervision while filming because the studio was also making Gladiator at the time, and was just paying way more attention to Gladiator.
Yeah, this one was kind of a under the radar sort of.
Yeah.
I remember I saw it at the theater at the time, but had not planned on it originally. I think, if my memory serves, I think it started getting a little bit of buzz in sort of geek community websites as being kind of legit. And then I was like, you know what? If only to see like kind of good, cool 1999 special effects handle something very much like Star Trek, I'll give it a shot. Mm-hmm. And I ended up, it was one of those really great surprises, you know, when you go to the theater and your expectations are low or moderate and you end up being like coming out on a real high. That was what this was for me.
That was a lot of people's experience, Dave. It was like the word of mouth because the movie like opened with like a $12 million weekend or something like that. And then like the next weekend, it made like another $12 million. And then like the next weekend, it made like another like it never went down. It just people kept coming to it. And that's a sign that you didn't market the movie well enough. But the word of mouth is carrying it.
In the documentary, I don't remember who said it, said like people who worked in the business came and it turned around and like recognized people who worked on it. They're like, wait, this is good. Why was it like marketed so weirdly?
It was because Rugrats made a lot of money. And DreamWorks was like, oh, Rugrats made a lot of money. So we want to make that money. So we're going to make this for kids. We're going to make Sigourney say screw that instead of fuck that.
Oh, apparently, according to the documentary, there's like a lot that like that's just the one instance that we can tell that happened, that they cut a lot of cussing out because it was originally supposed to be PG-13.
Do y'all agree that I think it probably was to its benefit to go a little bit more family friendly and cut that?
I think it makes them that kind of ages poorly. It's like no one says screw that. Like you would say the F word. It would still be like a PG-13 movie. Like in this day and age when like Marvel MCU movies can drop F bombs,
I don't think it would add that much. Like I would have laughed a little bit harder, but I kind of recognize that there's some stuff that's meant to be like something you can watch with like even like an 8 or 9 year old or something. And
the thing is, because I know that wasn't the movie they were intending to make, I would be really interested to see that cut.
Sure.
Yeah.
Just to see, like, well, like, one I know, I don't think they mentioned this in the documentary that I just watched, but now that you have Tony Shalhoub, they didn't mention this, so maybe this isn't true, but I have heard this before, that there's a deleted scene where he, like, smokes a joint, and that's why he's acting so weird the entire movie.
Oh.
Yeah, I assume that's one of my big complaints with the movie as a kid is I didn't like Fred Kwan. I was like, why is this guy like so weird? Like I didn't understand like what's his deal? He's just dumb and weird and friendly.
He's super low-key.
I've met enough like burnt out boomer stoners that at some point in their life they had a midlife crisis and broke down but then recovered from it and just became like very zen.
Yeah.
And just learn how to detach from everything in life that was causing them misery and just be totally, like, at peace. It's like, oh, yeah, I know exactly what this guy's personality type now.
I had watched Monk regularly. Mm-hmm. So, like he's a very good actor because this is so different from what I usually see him doing.
Yeah, you know, I never watched Monk. What was his personality on that?
Well, he is has extreme OCD.
OCD, right?
And he's, like, just very particular and... Mm. God, I'm trying to think of, like, how to say it without, like, coming off rude. And a lot of things are, like, very matter-of-fact, and he's, like, very... I'm having a hard time describing Monk. And, like, Monk is a very...
I know we don't want to accidentally be ableist or anything
like
that.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm running
into. Is he sort of high-strung, demanding, or...
Yeah, like, high-strung... Like, he has, like, an assist... Well, he has two different assistants throughout the show, but, like, they have to, like, carry around wipes for him. Like, that's how...
Yeah.
And, like, it's very funny, and it...
That's pretty different from Fred Kwan.
Yeah. And he's very funny, and it's, like, one of those things that I don't... It's, like, Tony Shalhoub playing him, you're, like, you're, like, if it was any other actor, I do not think that show would have lasted as long as it did, because, like, he would get annoyed with him. But, like, Tony Shalhoub is just charming enough to, like, make it work.
It turns out they had, like, a pretty perfect cast in this.
Yeah.
You know, like you said, Sam Rockwell, when he was just kind of getting rolling... And, you know, the big names to anchor it. You know, even Justin Long as the Uber nerd.
Oh, yeah. Who apparently is, like, 20. I was shocked when I learned he was not, like, actually a teenager in this, when he made this.
Yeah, yeah. He's got the perpetually youthful mm-hmm. look. I heard, I think I read somewhere he based his character partly on comic book guy from The Simpsons. And partly on...
And Marty McFly, which was a really... I thought, good idea. I was like, oh, that makes sense. That's, but now that I know that, when I watch this movie, like, pretty much, like, every line delivery he does is like, that's probably exactly how I would have done it, trying to marry together Marty McFly and the Simpsons comic book guy. But that's part of the, I think the charm of this movie is that there is so much relatability to it. So mm-hmm. much of it rings true. Like, as far as, like, the convention atmosphere or just, like, those types of dynamics, like the relationships between fandom and celebrity, and almost kind of specifically to Star Trek. I think it's carried over to other franchises at this day and age. But there really was, like something very unique and specific to Star Trek fandom that kind mm-hmm. of invented modern fandom, that, like, we wouldn't have, like anime convention culture wouldn't exist if it wasn't for, like, stuff like the Trekkies were doing in the 70s.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And it's, like, I would say you're a good example was, like, look at the Creation website and see, like, all of the different fandoms they have, like, conventions for.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's pretty wild. But you know, they do show this side of, you know, there's a little bit of sometimes the fans are made to look a little goofy or pathetic mm-hmm. in this. And then, you know, you might even be thinking that as a viewer, but then there's a scene early on that's one of, like, the more serious scenes after kind of a lot of comedy, when Jason is in the bathroom and he overhears the two guys who are kind of just at the convention to laugh at people. Mm-hmm. And they're talking about, you know, how he's a wash-up and everybody there is a loser and they don't know how, and, you know, but, like, they don't know how much the rest of the crew hates him. And it's, I feel like it's the first sort of really serious scene in the movie that kind of anchors mm-hmm. it. And you kind of see that, yeah, this movie is going to, like, even though it's kind of poking a little bit of fun at fandom here and there, is also definitely not on the side of people who make fun of fans.
Oh, yeah. And
those guys were jerks. They were assholes.
That is the other part that I think really dates the movie is, like, Sigourney saying, screw that. Mm-hmm. And then these dudes, when they say the R word, which is just a slur that I think people wouldn't include in a,
sure.
in a movie like this. But it works out kind of well that, like, those are kind of, like, the dickheads who said that. Yeah.
Speaking of Clueless, like, very nonchalantly, like, Cher says that word in Clueless. And every time I'm like, oh, I was like, it's the 90s. Like,
Right. It's kind of too bad when it hits a movie that's otherwise... Yeah. Could be kind of timeless.
No, but like, everyone said that word in 1990. Some people were probably, like, enlightened enough not to, but most of us said, like,
pretty,
Mr. Rogers would have said that in 1999. That
would
be an exaggeration.
Even
but.
In other countries, is not as, like, not used as not recently now, but this probably would have been closer to, like, 2018. I was in Australia, and someone, like, a friend of a friend, like, said that word, and I was just, like, genuinely shocked.
A lot of the stuff, like, in that opening, like, at the GalaxyCon convention, you know, like, mm-hmm. they get, like, the The movie kind of does this neat format where it opens with a clip of that we learn is from the final episode. So it opens like an episode of Galaxy Quest, and we see it in all of its glory, and then we see the fans celebrating it, and then we're like, oh, so it's like this cheesy thing, but it's like beloved by all these people all these years later, and then we see the actors and kind of the not miserable state, but just kind of the less comfortable state that they exist in.
I love they make Albert like. Alan Rickman wears that thing all the time.
Oh yeah, yeah. He has the rubber head glued to his scalp like the entire movie, like until like the very end. You get like a little peek of what's that's kind of like your reveal, you know? Like like you never see like the Phantom of the Opera like without his mask on until like the very end. You get some type of peek.
And I guess
that's kind of like that.
They, I guess, for the plot of the movie, you have to, because if they brought him and he didn't have that on, the Thermians would be like, what the hell? Like,
right. So that
was... Oh, yeah, that's a good point.
But yeah, that the scene you're talking about, Fathery, where they're in, like, the green room or whatever, you get these quick introductions of all the characters as they're kind of sniping at Jason Nesmith, the Kirk analog, while he's because he's late.
The Shatner analog, I guess.
Yeah, the Shatner analog, for sure. And everybody kind of gets you start to get a pretty quick, you know, painting of just who everybody is. You know, that Sigourney Weaver felt that she was the overlooked character who was kind of the eye candy with no real role. You know, that Alan Rickman was the Shakespearean actor who kind of felt it was beneath him.
He's kind of like Nimoy and Patrick Stewart combined.
Yeah, that's the vibe I always got.
Sigourney's character, she's kind of like Nichelle Nichols and Grace Lee Whitney both.
Mm-hmm.
But there's so much that rings true, like, at that convention scene. Like, yeah, like, they add some, I don't know, like, some shorthands for the mainstream audience. Like, having the actors show up, like, in costume. Like, actors would be, like, offended if you asked them to do that for, like, conventions. They're like, no, I don't want to, like, I mean, like, I know there's, like, occasions when stuff like that happens. But, but for the most part, like, so much of this, like, it feels realistic. Like, when Tim Allen is signing autographs and he's just, you know, eating up the glory of, like, telling these stories to his fans. Like, I've seen actors in that situation at conventions. I've also seen actors that are like kind of like grumpy and cranky, and you know they're doing their job but they're not having a good day at work.
And he gets you see both sides from the same person when he's just been signing long enough, he blows up.
In situations, I've definitely been where it was like when someone's grumpy, the best thing is when you like say something to them and you're and then they like actually like perk up, and I was like, oh, I got them to not be grumpy for a second. Like,
for sure. I think a lot of them, you know, they're just what we see here is they get tired of, you know, the fans that ask, you know, either the same questions over and over, or who kind of, you know, think that they love the franchise as much as the fans do, and expect them to kind of be invested in the lore, which is, you know, that's Justin Long's character. And they, you know, he hits Jason Nesmith at the wrong time, and he blows up at him like a big old jerk.
That bathroom scene that you mentioned, Dave, when... I don't know if I should call him Tim Allen or Jason Nesmith. If I say Nesmith, y'all know who I'm talking about. If I say Nesmith, okay, I'll say Nesmith.
I suppose every character in this is played by a famous actor whose name we know, and also has two character names you have to remember.
Yeah, so Tim Allen is Nesmith, Sigourney Weaver is Gwen DeMarco, Alan Rickman, Alexander Dane. So we'll try to stick with that. But when Nesmith is in the bathroom and he overhears the assholes, they're talking about, like, man, do you see all of these pathetic, washed-up actors? They can't get any real acting jobs, so they're out here begging for autographs. And that's, like, that hurts him. And he's, like, crying in, like, the stall. He's, like, devastated by it. Like, I promise you that, like the William Shatners out there, like, all, like, these actors who go to conventions, like, they've heard, like, that type of stuff. Like, they've had, like, those cries in the bathroom stalls. Like, it just rings so true.
For sure. Is that before he blows up at Justin
Long? That's right before he yells at him.
It's what brings him down so much that he's, like, in that mental place that he does it. Yeah, there's you know, that's some nice bit of writing there. We see it's not just that it's been a long day, it's that somebody, like, you know, shot him down psychologically hard.
Yeah.
Yeah, and even though he's, like, the jerk who, like, shows up late and he's so, like, self-absorbed and doesn't even, like, understand how big of an asshole he is to everyone else, like, we can still kind of empathize with, okay, but it's still, I can still understand, like, it would hurt your feelings to hear that, especially to like this guy who probably, you know, thinks really highly of himself.
And it's funny because, like, in actuality, and maybe this is more now than it was then, if you have a loyal fan base from, like, a specific thing, they will follow you to anything that you will do. Like...
Yeah, I'm sure that's only become more difficult. But, you know, I know that this movie rings true from the actor perspective, because so many Star Trek actors, and I've also heard, like, Babylon 5 actors and people from other shows that are similar to the Trek franchise, but they say, like, oh my god, I love the Galaxy Quest movie so much. Patrick Stewart famously talks about how, like, he didn't want to see this movie at first, and then Jonathan Frakes told him, Patrick, you have to see it. It is so good, and it's not like mean. It's not, like, attacking the fans. It's not attacking us, but just go see it. And he was like, I loved it. And I think a lot of the scenes, like when we have DeMarco and Dane talking to each other on the phone about Nesmith, their old coworker, I think that felt like, oh, yeah, a lot of, like, castmates have these types of phone calls.
Oh, definitely. No, Brent Spiner's in the documentary. One thing, he was like, I wish we had done this. Like, that would have been, like...
The funny thing is that now Paramount owns this movie. It's part of, like, the Paramount Pictures library. But yeah. I'm glad that it was, like, made, like, its own thing separately. It doesn't have any of, like, the Star Trek sound effects or anything like that would have been licensed. They had to make... Because there's really, like, some smart choices. Like Thermians, for example, how they kind of have, like, that Romulan Vulcan haircut, but it's still, like, kind of, like, their own thing. But it's just kind of, like, that little, like, echo of, like, an actual Star Trek touchstone.
Yeah, you know, Father, you were talking about the shorthands they used at the convention. There's a lot of shorthands for Trek conventions and tropes in this. And there's not like we actually see a lot of Star Trek aliens that are quite like this goofy. But, you know, for a it gives them a lot of visual comedy by doing that. They were able to make use of, like, building the Thermians from the ground up.
Honestly, because of how funny it is, even though it does have, like, all this Trek shorthand, I've definitely shown this movie to people in my life who know little to know about Star Trek, and they just find it funny, and it's a good movie on its own, which I think makes it, like, helps it.
I showed this movie to the other day when we watched it in the Text Trek Discord a few nights ago. So that's another good reason people should join the Text Trek Discord. I was also watching this with a friend who came over, and she was seeing it for the first time, and she loved the movie. She was, like, so impressed with it. She was like, I can't believe I've never seen this movie. It's so good.
But no, in the documentary, they say it was the first time lawyers were involved because they wanted to, like, they very much did not want to get sued by Paramount. But apparently on somewhere the ship, before the numbers is not, it's just NTE, and apparently it stands for Not the Enterprise.
Yes.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Like, yeah, I love when the special effects people have those cheeky little inputs like that, that they don't actually, like, hurt anything. They don't actually, like, stand out if you don't know the in-joke. The actual, like, part of the movie when it becomes, like, a science fiction movie, like when does it actually, like, give it away? The Thermians are kind of subtle, like, their alien behavior.
I would love to show this movie to someone who doesn't know the plot, because by the time I watched the movie, I was told the basic summary, like, they go to space, and I was like, okay, cool, that sounds fun.
Like, my dad has only seen the first 30 minutes of From Dusk Till Dawn, the Robert Rodriguez, Quentin Tarantino movie. And, like, to this day, I think he thinks it's just a movie of, like, oh, he has, like, the Gecko brothers or, like, these criminal, like, escaped fugitives. And, like, they take, like, a family hostage and they're going down to Mexico. I don't know what happens after that. Like, he never got to the vampire stuff, and I think that's hilarious.
It reminds me, for a long time on Netflix, it was clear, and very much for Frasier was the one, it was clear whoever wrote the descriptions watched the first scene of each episode and tried to write the descriptions off there. And so some of them were just totally off. And I was like, this is bizarre. And I would love to see someone do that with a bunch of movies.
Yeah, this would be one that would be, you would get some weird descriptions if you did that. But the audience is kind of informed before Nesmith is, because they do show us the alien ship, Saris's ship. So it does confirm to us, like, no, he is actually in space. But I think they wait long enough. You know, they give us, like, the car getting beamed up and the dog barking at it before that. Like, they wait long enough that you kind of figure it out on your own before they confirm it for you.
Interestingly, apparently the car being beamed up was apparently a studio note, and they wanted you to think maybe it was a dream when Nesmith first goes up.
Oh, interesting.
Right. Which is why he, like, wakes up. I like how it turns out, because... Mm-hmm. I think that might have been more of, like, a choice for making it more of a family movie, as they want the kids to be able to understand what's happening. Mm-hmm. But I think the way that the final product, how it's, like, actually edited, there's something I find satisfying about it.
Like, I'm glad the dog barking is there, because it keeps the tone of a comedy as opposed to just, like, a shot of the car moving somewhere.
Oh, yeah. Alien abduction can be horrifying.
Right. It's just, it's a little bit of visual humor that adds something to it.
And I guess he just thinks that he's doing a fan film. He thinks that, like, someone's, like, arranged, like, a like some little fan film cameo, which some of the actors, like, did do, like, Takei and Koenig and Tim Russ.
It's Justin Long's friends are the people he's supposed to be meeting.
Okay.
Right. Oh, that's why when he bumps into him, he's like, there seems to be a miscommunication.
Miscommunication. Yeah. Okay.
That's why he's they are the people.
Right. Got it. Nesmith says, like, you know, oh, this is a better setup than they usually have at some point.
Yeah. he was really impressed. Yeah, what a doofus. Like, could you picture, like, Shatner, like, doing all of this? Like, I can. Like, I can.
Yeah, and he's hungover a bit, too. Yeah. He's working through it. By the way, you know, I want to quick give a shout-out. I forget who the actor was who plays Saris. But he's, like, so dripping with evil, such a skeevy bad guy,
such a good villain.
That I love him, yeah.
The design is great, the creature effects. So there is some really good production value in this. You know, it was at a time when, you know, Steven Spielberg was, like, people were investing heavily into DreamWorks. They were putting a lot of money into their movie, or a lot of effort, whatever. Like, they all looked good. Everything they were making around this time looked good.
Like, I'm glad this movie was made when it was, and not a couple years later, because I feel like there would have been a lot more CGI.
Yes. The CG in this movie is used so perfectly.
Yeah.
It's not overused. It's not underused. This movie came out the same year as The Phantom Menace, and I think it ages so much better because it has, they only use CGI when it actually looks good.
I remember thinking as I watched it that I'm like, yeah, I know it's a comedy and there's, you know, it's mostly a lot of goofy stuff in it, but I was like, what is it? The Protector, their ship and mm-hmm. and Saris' ship. I'm like, they look pretty badass. They look really good. I mean, you know, it made me want to almost invest in that world, you know, to see some sort of follow up, you know, because, you know, it was just such a good looking stuff.
Yeah, and it was ILM who were doing all of the Star Wars and Star Trek movies at the time, so like they knew how to make it, like, you know, not look quite as good, but make it look in the same style.
Yep.
And they knew, like, how to kind of cheat and, like, do, like, here's the shots. They're going to look, like, really great if we save the money for, like, this shot and stuff like that. Rachel, we should talk about, like, the cool thing with the, like, the aspect ratio of the movie. If you see it in the theater, it changes. The
aspect ratio changes twice because when the movie starts, it's in
4:3.
4:3, the square, and then it goes to, I don't remember any of these numbers. That's the problem.
4:3 is, like,
classic television square.
So perfect for the TOS/TNG look.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then it gets a little bit wider. I think it's wider again when Nesmith is about to be sent back to Earth. I guess when he realizes, like, oh, I'm not in some type of, like, grounded real life dramedy. Yeah. I am in an epic science fiction movie.
It
action
goes
adventure
to, like,
thing.
Like a more cinematic aspect ratio.
Yeah.
Right. And that's when he's, like, on the transporter pad, he sees, like, this, you know,
this, like,
massive
space
widescreen, you know, clearly it's blocked off by a force field or whatever, mm-hmm. but, you know, he sees this vast, you know, stretch of space, makes huge use of the widescreen look, you know, it's a gorgeous shot of a ringed planet with multiple other planets in the background, and so, yeah, it functions in a weird way, like, or not a weird way, but like a deliberate way, like going from black and white Kansas to color, you know, in Wizard of Oz.
Yeah, exactly. We're not exactly, but yeah, it's kind of like that same style. And also, like, tonally, you get a big shift when it cuts from his epic space action adventure to the rest of the cast. I guess they're at, like, the grand opening of, like, a circuit city.
Yeah, and I remember looking, I was like, oh this is rough. Like, this is what they're doing.
I think it's got one of the most memorable lines in it from poor Alan Rickman's character. By Grapthar's hammer, what a savings. As they cut the ribbon on the news store.
It's funny, that line, I was like, oh, that's why he hates the line. He was like, line probably did mean something when he originally said it, and now it's this.
But they have to do the comedy thing, like, they have to, like, do it, like, three times, then along the third time it's different, you know?
Yeah.
So they have to keep doing, like, the grab Thor's hammer so that you could have, like, the well, it's not even, like, used for a joke. It is at first when he's like, don't say it, when he's all mad, like, hearing the line, but then when he's able to, like, say it in his big moment later that I'm sure we'll talk about. But what I love about this moment in the film is that Nesmith, when he does get, like, this big, like, exciting thing in his life, he was so, like, depressed and miserable when he woke up hungover, mm-hmm. feeling like a washed-up nobody has been. And then he's all, like, excited and thrilled. It reminds me in real life of when Shatner went to space for real. He actually kind of, like, acted like he was all, like, enthused and excited and wanted to tell everyone about it.
Yeah, even though he had some slightly dark observations afterwards. I mean, they were kind of grounded in, like, hey, we need to take care of our planet, but it was a little sad.
It made him have, like, a midlife crisis, of, like, 40 years later than, like, most people.
A Twilight life crisis.
Yeah.
But, you know, this is something that one of the things I love most about the movie is that it does present us a pretty appealing fantasy, I think, of mm-hmm. sort of how we wish Shatner could be. That he could be like Jason Nesmith and have a little bit more of a heart of gold. And when he sees that he's hurt someone, feel apologetic about it and not be a blowhard. And, you know, we just, we want that. Because we've seen, you know, like, the TNG cast and subsequent casts be more like that. And so it's a very appealing wish.
It's like if William Shatner acted just a little bit more like Kirk.
Just a little bit.
Just a little bit. It's funny. The one quote I've seen from an actor was William Shatner being like, it's a good movie, but I don't get what Tim Allen was doing. And I was like, oh, buddy.
Oh, man.
Like, I think, as Aaron said, Shatner's just not self-aware enough to understand that. I'm like, this is you coming off better than you do in real life.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I think it's funny that so many actors do, like, love the movie, though. And it is kind of meaner to actors than it is to the fans. You know, they
it definitely,
like,
is.
Like, when it shows them all, like, react negatively to Nesmith being like, oh, you won't believe me, they had a ship and everything. And they're like, oh, my God, is this guy drunk? Is he making mm-hmm. fun of us? What is he doing? Like, is he really, like, offering us to be a part of, like, this gig or whatever? And then they're like, hey, we're all desperate for work. Do you think he's ever going to, like, offer anything to us, like, ever again? And then they all go, like, running after him. But it is like... Yeah, like a lot of actors who were on, like, you know, one big show, and, like, they are kind of, like, desperate to get, like, their next big acting job. And I
considering how acting works, like, if you're not making money then, you're not, like, not getting insurance. So, like.
Oh, right. For sure.
And, like, what I think why it works as well as it does is by punching more to the actors, they're punching more up than down. So it doesn't come off as, like, mean as it could if they were punching more down to the fans.
But it is kind of an industry, I guess, that is... And I know that I say this as, like, an internet content creator that is not, like, that far away. But it's kind of an industry that is going to be full of people who crave attention. So I think like, they're talking about me in this movie. But, like, Hollywood really does love movies about Hollywood. Like, anytime they make a movie about movies, it wins a lot of awards. You know, like, La La Land, Hellseizer, like, all that stuff.
Recently had a friend who asked, like, oh, why do you do, like, the podcast and, like, TikTok and stuff? And they're like, is it for attention? I was like, not, like, influencer attention, but, like, I was like, I like performing. And, like, I was like, a little bit for attention, I guess. I don't want to get into that. Like,
yeah, we're just a very social species, and sometimes it manifests in this way of communication, but... What did y'all think when the crew comes on board and we get to see, like, their reactions to being in a sci-fi movie? Which, I guess it's more of, like, a 90s thing, but the idea of, like, scary alien abduction, but when they're, like, I don't know, what are the octopus things doing to them?
I think it looks like they're probing them. I'm pretty sure they're just making sure they didn't, like, accidentally pick up a disease.
Yeah.
It's probably, like, a medical tricorder, right?
I think so. I think it's easy for us to be like, oh, these have good intentions because we see the Thermians, how they actually are throughout the rest of the movie. And you're like, yeah, they're fine. Like,
but yeah, these characters do not know that. And mm-hmm. of course, it's just a great visual gag that, you know, we will find out that is their true form. These big Cthulhu-looking tentacle blobs paid off to amazingly in a love scene later on.
Yeah, or Missy Pyle earlier when her translator's broken and just screams.
Yeah.
Like,
but, you know, I guess you have, like, a bit of freedom in a comedy is that mm-hmm. you can do, like, weird alien things and you don't have to worry about, like, is this going to look, like, stupid on screen? Because it's like, oh, we're making a comedy. We want it to look stupid. That'll make people laugh. So.
And this is where it was, I think, good that they were not having to work with the Trek license per se. They didn't have to worry that they'd be, like, oh, say, making, you know, Gorn or something look like that look corny. Mm-hmm. They could do their own thing.
Yeah, you don't want to, like, make fun of, like, the Magato or the Horda or whatever. We want to respect all those and treat it with... We're kind of, like, big crybabies, aren't we? We would all be, like, whining if they...
Also, seeing their true form makes sense why they're, like, the aliens' other form is humans, but it's not quite right.
The aliens, yeah, every alien creature we see in this movie is pretty different from Earth creatures, I guess. Yeah,
but like them, they're trying to act more Earth creature, but they're like, no.
The Thermians themselves, when we see them in human form in their jumpsuits, they actually look more like a 50s or 60s sci-fi alien with the kind of, you know, the kind of slick jumpsuits and kind of slightly goofy even.
Forbidden Planet.
Yeah, like Forbidden Planet or even like Plan 9 from Outer Space on the campier side of things.
But Gene Roddenberry liked Forbidden Planet. Like, he clearly was inspired by it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, Forbidden Planet is a step above script, special effects, audio, and all of that stuff. And it wanted to say something. You know, it's almost impossible not to love the Thermians when you see this. I think everybody likes them. They're kind of childlike, of course. They're naive, but we see them be heroic. Their sincerity is extremely appealing. Yeah, they're just utterly sincere about everything.
Oh, yeah.
And the actors portraying them have created these visual tics and walks and all that. And I read that they did, like, they used some of their, I think, their improvisation that they did. And it's such a great mixture of things.
And improv is such, like, a big thing with, like, comedy now, it seems like. That's what everyone talks about.
Oh, yeah.
But
I was somewhere in that documentary, to double check how to pronounce his name, Enrico, I do not know how to pronounce that last name. It's very Italian.
But the guy who plays Mathisar, yeah, I know
Mathisar.
Who you're talking about. But
apparently,
Colin Tony,
like,
I think.
Yeah, apparently he auditioned. He was like, oh, I have this other silly thing I was thinking of. I'm like, do it. And they did that and apparently liked it so much they were showing it to other people in their auditions. Be like, can you imitate this? Because I think they were thinking, like, that's what we're going with.
But they're good at being consistent. Like, they all clearly come off as like, okay, you're not from my planet. But they all seem like they're from the same planet, you know? They can be individuals, but still feel like they're all part of the same alien species.
Mm-hmm. Although they did say something that as soon as they would turn around, you were like, he was like, I felt bad for the extras who were just like, wait, what do we have to do?
You know, I bet that was all fun stuff to do.
Yeah.
Unless you are, like... No one stood out. There is no one who's like, he's not Thermian, and he's not a Thermian. I mean, like, I watch, like, Star Trek 4, and I'll be like, why are these Vulcans smiling in the background? That's shame on you, Vulcan extra in 1986.
The Thermians beat them.
Yeah.
But I love Nesmith's enthusiasm, how it continues here, when he's just like, no, this isn't the ship. This is a starport for the ship. Would you like to see the ship? And he's just, like, so happy to have something to, like, show off to these people. And you get the idea, like, oh, that's all this guy wants. He just wants to be, like, the cool guy who has friends who like him because they think he's cool. And, yeah, that's why he wants to be, like, the lead. He wants to be not just, like, the captain of a ship, but he wants to be the lead actor in the cast of actors to kind of, like, lead the rest of the cast on stage. And you see that, like, throughout the movie when he tries to lean into, like, that leadership, he becomes, like y'all were saying, like, yeah, the guy y'all want Shatner to be when he's able to, like, inspire them, when he's able to, like, you know, Fred, you've never missed a mark or missed a line or whatever, or when Tommy, yeah, you can drive the ship. They based it on all your movements, everything. He really is doing that thing that a lot of times we hear in, like, actor interviews when they're just like, oh yeah, like, you know, when I'm on the set of Discovery, you know, I look to Sinequa, she's a great leader and stuff like that.
You know, you talk about when he's helping out Laredo in his flying. And he says, yeah, they based it on your movements. He says it the way you help out somebody without... He doesn't want to blow that they're not really, actual, Star Trek crew. And so he's like, they based it on your movements. And he gives him the hint. It's like reminding somebody of their line without repeating it. And so he's, like, kind of subtly doing a very good thing, trying to, you know, he's working for the team suddenly.
Yeah. As someone who's did a lot of theater in my past, I've had to do that for people and had to have that done for me.
Rachel, I feel like you're like that in real life. I feel like you're, like, always, like, thoughtful and helpful. You and Dave both. Y'all are both, like...
Thanks.
I'm always like, man, I would never be, like, that smart in the moment to think, like, here's, like, a subtle way I can be more helpful.
Well, that's very, very kind of you to say, Fathery.
That's very kind, yeah. Maybe that is the theater where I'm just like, let me help this person who clearly forgot their line.
But all the ship stuff looked cool when he's struggling to, like, pilot the ship, and we get, like, kind of the joke of him, like, crashing into the side of the base or whatever. But it's still, like, it looks really realistic and really good. And then when you get, like, a look at, like, the entire base built in the asteroid, pretty cool.
And, like, it's fun because, yeah, it looks so good. And a lot of times when I show people older Star Trek, I have to often be like, some of it hasn't aged well. Just go with the vibe. It's from the 60s. And this, I'm like, no, it looks cool. Like, We're good.
A lot of movies from the late 90s age really well because, like, they're shot on, like, very good film, and it looks great on, like, modern TVs and 4K, until you see, like, a CGI shot, and then it looks very bad. But because this movie uses CGI so intelligently,
it doesn't
have that issue.
You know what? And I'll be glad. I'm glad that little bug looked CGI because I didn't want to imagine a real bug.
When poor Alexander Dane has to eat the blood tick, when everyone else is like, you see Nesmith has like a steak and baked potato in the mess hall scene.
Yeah, the Thermians have kindly provided them with what they expect for their species.
I love Alan Rickman's line reading of just like Mother used to make.
Yes. He's just resigned to it. By the way, early on, I think one of my favorite moments early on is when they're in the green room is when Nesmith, you see his first bit of, I suppose, leadership when, you know, Dane refuses to go on. And he's like, nothing you can say would make me, you know, walk out there. And he's like, the show must go on.
I was like, oh, he knows him well.
He does, like, this is a little under his breath. Damn you.
Yeah.
It's the first rule of show business, but that's also something that, like, rings true. It's like, oh yeah, like that. Like a lot of people go around saying, like, yeah, that's the first rule of show business, right?
So. Yeah, it's Nesmith both being arguably manipulative, but also kind of a bit of a leader.
There's such like a fast pace in like the first half of the movie, isn't it? Because it does have like a pretty long like third act and kind of like drawn out. You know, it takes like Saris like 3 or 4 attempted kills before they finally stop them. But so much happens so quickly in the first half of the movie. It's paced really well.
Like, yeah, I feel like you've earned it by the time you're getting to like, and things are going to slow down a little bit to show off more action.
Because then, like, as soon as they kind of have like the mess hall scene and they kind of explain to the rest of the Galaxy Quest cast and also like the audience kind of more the details of Saris, of oh yeah, he survived that attack and now like he's really pissed off, and oh, it turns out we had another captain before you that he actually like tortured to death, and that's how he found out about the Omega 13, and nobody knows what it does because the show didn't get picked up for a fifth season, so the cliffhanger was never concluded.
It's funny, that does not necessarily ring true to me for Star Trek. It does ring true to me for a lot of other shows, especially in the modern era. There's a bunch of shows that only last 2 seasons on Netflix, and you're like, and how does that end? I have no fucking clue.
Like, that actually, it's actually more relatable now than it was in 99. Like, this is more common now.
Yeah.
What it is, though, is a clever device to allow them to have the fan speculation end up being very key to the finale.
Yeah, exactly.
Even though, yeah, it's not quite a Trek trope to be canceled on a cliffhanger. You know, at this point, the movie starts to become essentially, it's almost like watching a few quick Star Trek episodes. Mm-hmm. It's just a question of, can these people now live up to the roles that they understand at this point they are supposed to? But now it's not like, it's not just like their public reputation or their jobs on the line. It's lives. It's like the galaxy is on the line and they have to live up to it.
And it's very clear that, like, it's not just this ship. I was like, Saris is evil. Like, Saris will continue to hurt people if you let him go.
The clip of him torturing, like, the other alien is pretty disconcerting in the middle of an otherwise pretty family-friendly movie.
When we saw that in the theater, the person who was, like, sitting to the left of me, they were shivering in their seat at, like, the octopus being tortured. They had, a really really strong reaction to that.
You know, sometimes when I think, when you kind of go more all ages, and also when you have, like, the high level of sincerity that you're used to accompanying, like, Disney movies and things like that, when you get these moments of angst or sadness, they can really feel intense because it's just pure raw emotion. So later on, when Saris does, like, forces Nesmith to own up to it in front of Mathazar, it's like the most horrible thing. It's just so wrenching.
But you're right, Dave. Like, the reason why that is so effective is that, like, when a movie can, like, get you invested emotionally, like, early on, and, like, you don't realize it, but, like, you've already, like, opened up, like, your heart and feelings to the movie, and you're, like, locked in. Like, then, now, like, the movie can, like, really F with you. Now it can really make you feel strong.
I know. I think it's, like, when you have a lot of one emotion, when you do the other, it hits well. Like, this, when it's, like, everything's very sincere. So when something bad happens, you feel it. And I've also felt the opposite. When there's shows where it's like everything bad happens, when like one good thing happens, you're like, oh my God, something good happened.
Yeah. That was how Galactica worked sometimes.
The two I think of are like Game of Thrones. Anytime like the first time you're like characters reunite, you're like, oh my god, something not horrible happened to these people.
A sort of little clear-cut win, at least for a moment.
Yeah, and then there's one a moment in the Handmaid's Tale where like a good thing happened for two characters that I was like, I think I cried because I was just like, I'm just so used to this show being so depressing.
When Saris makes his I guess second attempt at negotiations with the Protector. But they kind of spoof the Wrath of Khan, where it's similar to the prefix code scene.
Right.
But here, DeMarco didn't know what he was trying to signal to her, so instead, like...
I agree, we're dead.
Yeah, instead, like, Saris hears him say, like, okay, if this guy's as ugly as he is stupid...
Right, he gives his secret plan, and instead of it being muted, it's all... it's a hot mic. Yeah, and that's both. It's great because it's both. It's funny, but it's also at this point, Saris has kind of shown himself to be a real threat, and you're kind of like, oh shit.
Yeah, now that we know that like he tortures people to death, like we're not
doesn't
stage
he also
actors.
Open
this is for real.
This scene with like one of his officers' head on a spike.
Oh yeah.
He'll like, kill his own men.
Yeah,
Saris is not like a really like deep villain, but like I'm okay with that. Like I think he's fine for like what this movie needed. We didn't need like a Khan level bad guy running around. He's just there to just cause problems and be scary, and he's
also
great at that.
Also, because you have such a big cast, and you don't like in the actual Star Trek movie, you don't necessarily need to build up the supporting cast as much because you have a TV show with them.
Right,
this you have
characters.
To build up the entire cast to for you to care about them. That you're like, we don't have time to make you kind of care about this villain. He's evil and he kills people. Are you on board? Like,
and he's dripping with malice too.
And it really reminds me of Shatner and Nimoy when Nesmith didn't understand the show, when he didn't understand like you can't hold down the turbo, it'll break the ship. You're only supposed to use it for quick boosts. Because Nimoy really understood Star Trek. I've seen so many clips of Nimoy at a convention in 1990 or 1984 or 2002, and he's describing a scene from the original series, like perfect, like quoting dialogue either exactly or almost exactly. And I've seen like Shatner at conventions say stuff like, "Oh yeah, you know, one of our great episodes, City on the Edge of the River," and stuff like that. So it's very much like those personality types here. They didn't have like the rivalry that these two have. That's kind of more of like a Takei or a Duhan thing against Shatner. But that rings true as well. When you know the moments in here when he's like, you know, like you stole all my best lines and stuff. Like Shatner would do that. He would be like, "No, I think this line should go to the captain. I think this moment should be about Kirk's reaction. I think it should all be about the main character Kirk."
You know what's interesting is that every once in a while he was probably right. You know, that just structuring, you know, that show or a little bit more around a central character, or occasionally an episode at least.
I think the problem is
makes
like
some sense.
Is like because he was such a jerk and like everything else as well.
Mm-hmm.
That like it didn't help, I don't think.
Maybe not. Yeah. It depends on kind of whether you're trying to do more ensemble at any given moment or to zero in. Fathery, one of my favorite scenes is something that you have pulled up a slide of. This is a scene of Tony Shalhoub as Fred Kwan, seemingly stoned, but delivering the most chill version of Scotty's panic as he explains that the reactors can't take it anymore and they're going to blow up everything, just FYI, to the captain.
You said, like, seemingly stoned. Like, I assume he's stoned, like, throughout the entire movie, except for like, in the opening when it shows, like, his footage from 1982. That's the only time I think he's not supposed to be under the influence of cannabis.
Yeah.
I love that, and I also love when he goes and he's like, "Hey, they have this idea. Let's do that." He's like, "Oh, you were right, guys." I went, "Yeah, they don't." I was like, "You know these people? They don't know what they're talking about." Like,
in that scene, by the way, the visual gag of like there's explosions going on in the background with like Thermians flying by,
and it looks really good.
Yeah,
but it's funny too because of his low key reaction.
I know it wasn't out yet, but it almost kind of looks like in Star Trek 09 when, like, the ships are getting blown up and there's people being, like, sucked out into space and stuff like that.
In the documentary, someone who worked on Star Trek 09 was saying, like, he's like, "Yeah, we definitely, like, thought about Galaxy Quest because it's so good."
But whenever there are like new Star Trek shows or movies, I always hear like these actors talk about like, yeah, everyone tells me I got to watch Galaxy Quest now. So, or they'll say like, oh, I finally watched Galaxy Quest and I love that movie. It's so like relatable. So it's just really fascinating to me. That's part of what I've been most fascinated, I guess, like taking this deeper look at Galaxy Quest is like, well, why do all of these actors love it so much? What are these little honest bits that like, you know, these actors are like relating to that I probably would probably go over my head. There's that moment where the one Thermian, who's the big fanboy for Alexander Dane's character, Dr. Lazarus.
Oh, I think Quaelic, right?
Quaelic.
Yeah.
Okay.
But him telling him like, oh, I've based my entire life on the philosophies of your people. It's like I'm sure Nimoy lost count of the number of people came up to him and told him like, I live my life as though I was a Vulcan.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I imagine Michael Dorn hit quite a number of people who said that about his presentation.
Dave, I'm so embarrassed to. I've never said this story on the show before.
Okay.
But when I was 16 years old, I wrote a letter to Michael Dorn telling him like how much his performance like inspired my how I live my life,
I
and handed it to him in El Paso, Texas. And like to this day, like I cringe thinking like I hope he never read that. Like some of the shit I said in there.
Like you being 16 makes it very sweet to me.
I feel like I have a few things like that in my life, like with letters to comic books and things. But yeah, that's like that, you know, but in a way that's how important these things, you know, that's why we talk mm-hmm. about our entertainment, why we spend a couple hours a week on Text Trek talking about a story, because yeah, these things have meaning. Good stories are important to how humanity functions, and we, you know, we connect on such a level that you would want to do that, you know. Yeah, maybe it's a little cringe in retrospect, but you know, what does it mean? It meant it changed you, you know, it meant something to you.
Honestly, if you're not a little cringe throughout your life, you're like not really living.
Well, that's what teenage years are for. That's to get all your cringe out in your teenage years, and then like you spend your 20s recovering from it.
You spend your 20s finding out the people who are cringe like you, and those are your friends, and they're great.
I like this. This is a good solid examination of how our geek culture works, and probably almost everybody else too.
Well, let's examine the landing party mission when they go down to the planet. They have to find the replacement beryllium sphere. That's like our dilithium. That's like our warp core, or whatever, you know, our convenient MacGuffin we need for the story. Perfect for a Star Trek type story. Go down to this planet has some type of mining facility.
I think this really goes to what your idea where it was like it took a couple different Star Trek episodes, because this definitely feels like a distinct Star Trek episode with these horrible childlike murderers.
Little gremlin children.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it kind of evokes Trouble with Tribbles, you know, like a mm-hmm. bunch of a bunch, this thing that seems kind of innocent at first, but then, like, you know, when there's a whole bunch of them, it might be a handful. And there's also, like, elements of Arena, because it's kind of like a Vasquez rock-looking landscape.
I think what's so good is, like, there's so many good set pieces. The jokes aren't sacrificed for the set piece, and the set piece isn't sacrificed for the jokes. Like, they all work very well together.
Mm-hmm. That's kind of like the best way to, you know, when it's really funny, when things mm-hmm. can feel like very real and I don't know, kind of something like you can kind of like see yourself existing there. And then like when the joke happens, it's just so much funnier.
You know, this was also a neat thing because it just gave you a new visual environment. You know, like you said, Father, mm-hmm. we get our Vasquez Rocks type homage. You get like an old mining station and some new aliens, so in that sense it's just a visual pop for the movie as well.
It's kind of like the other Star franchise has the philosophy that I think or kind of invented the philosophy that a lot of movies adopted after that, but like your action adventure, you kind of need three different set pieces, you know. You need like the desert, the Death Star, and then the rainforest. You gotta do like three different things, and then the next one you do like snowy place, swamp, and then cloud place. It's like here we have like okay, normal Earth world, we have the ship, and then we have a away mission planet.
Pretty solid formula, as it turns out.
Yeah, it works well.
And I also love like them playing in the trope where like Guy is convinced he's gonna die on this planet.
Yeah,
right. That's Guy Fleegman, aka Sam Rockwell's character, who was really just an extra and is pretty sure he's the red shirt of the bunch. Mm-hmm.
But that's another thing that I'm not going to say any names, but there's actors who were extras on Star Trek shows, and they do, like, they go to conventions and they try to, you know, become part of the fandom and sit in, like, sign autographs and try to, you know, squeeze into the whatever places they can get into and be part of that also. Like, that was another thing that, like, rang true. I'm glad that I see that, like, when they get, like, the reboot, they give his character a name, and he has some, like, ridiculous name, like
Rock
or something.
One of my favorite jokes of this is, like, Sigourney Weaver, or Gwen is not worried about herself. She says, we have to go before one of those things kills Guy.
Oh, yeah.
Right. It's like they've been kind of trying to calm him down, like, oh, yeah. No, you're going to be okay, you're going to be okay. And then she's like, he's probably going to die, we need to go.
Yeah, that kind of, like, realization of like, oh, y'all were all just saying that just to make me feel better. It's not true. I really am going to die. Oh, no, this is so much even worse than I thought.
No, it's one of the joke is the miners, not miners, but he's trying to explain, like...
Yeah.
But because I recently had that happen in real life, where I was trying to explain someone the story of how root beer got its name, and originally it was called root tea, and it was changed to root beer because they thought it would, like, appeal more to the miners around them, and they went, "Why would beer?" I was like, "No, miners as in, like, mining things, not miners as in children."
Is it this exact sequence where Jason Nesmith, like, he, like, does some Kirk style rolls?
Yeah.
You know, kind of cheesily, like, anything.
When he's fighting the pig lizard, and then after that he fights the rock monster. Well, that was a fun reveal, how, like, they all start chanting for, what was it, Grognak?
Grignak or something
Grignak.
Like that. And, he's like...
Grignak.
Well, you know, they end up being threatening looking. At first they're childlike, then they've got the fangs, and then you see they've got their big champion, this giant rock man.
His shirt comes off.
He gets his shirt torn, dealing with it, even as, like, the rest of the crew gets away. And so he's kind of being, you know, he's showing a heroic turn here. But they don't know if they can beam him up, because when they beamed up the pig thing, it explodes.
It comes inside out and explodes.
Yeah.
That was one of the biggest laugh out loud moments for me watching this for the first time. And I guess it would have been 2000. But I remember I was watching it at my grandma's house, and she asked me, like, what were you laughing so loud about earlier? I knew, like, it had to have been this. I was, like, laughing, like, so loud everyone in the house would have heard me. Yeah. And I was trying to explain it to her. It was like the alien beams up the pig lizard, but it's, like, turned inside out, and they're all kind of, like, freaked out by it. But he's talking to the captain on the phone, and he's telling him, like, oh, the creature beamed up inside out. Then it explodes. And then he said, and it exploded. And she's like, that's what made you laugh that loud? And I was like, yeah, it's funnier if you were there.
The performances are what makes it show. Like,
yeah.
A truly bizarre thing, apparently, for this documentary, apparently the way the script was is that he's just shirtless throughout the rest of the movie.
Tim Allen
was like, that's really weird.
Yeah, that would be a bit much. They were right to change that.
Yeah.
But there's not really, like, a good moment for him to put the shirt back on. So he gets it on, like, super quick. Like, as soon as he gets back in the transporter room, like, they just happen to have, like, a shirt there waiting for him. It's just, like, the shirt he was wearing earlier.
They were joking about that. I guess we beamed it up for him. I don't know. But it's... Tim Allen said, like, he's like, I understood why my shirt had to come off for, like, the Shatner-esque thing. He's like... I did not want to do the rest of the movie shirtless.
But he got in good shape for, like, the one shirtless scene. So good on him.
Fun fact from the thing: he had a personal trainer who he is now married to.
Oh well, I guess that one worked out for people.
Yeah. Worked out for him at least.
Yeah,
I guess it, like, worked out for her. She's like, well, I'm gonna marry you, but first I'm gonna, like, train you to have, like, the body that I want to get married to first. That might be good motivation. That might be, maybe that's what, I need a trainer like that to get me in shape, maybe.
By the way, this scene, you know, they managed to rescue him, of course. And it's the last we see, or we think it's probably the last we'll see of Grignak. But he gets a guest appearance a little later on during a climactic scene. That's like just a fantastic sort of payback moment. Mm-hmm. A good guy win when it happens.
Another comment, I guess, on kind of, like, the fast pace of the movie, you know, like, as soon as they're back from the away mission, it's like Saris is, like, there, like, on the ship. So, you know, you just get, like, enough of, like, the victory to just kind of, like, feel, like, a little bit of reward as an audience member. And then, like, immediately you're like, oh, no, we're back in, like, dire stakes.
Yeah, and this is like a kind of a classic Trek scene, you know, a capture sequence, you know, a definitely we're at our lowest ebb. This guy's got, you know, every advantage, and this is the scene where he, you know, forces Tim Allen when he realizes that Mathazar and the other Thermians think that they're real, you know, that the show was real and all that, and he forces him to tell them the truth and basically utterly crush their spirits.
And this is why I say, like, the movie didn't need, like, a deeper villain than Saris. So I was like, no, like, he was, like, nasty enough, like, as is. Like, he's, like, he was, like, a good, like, Megatron. To me, like, he's mm-hmm. Megatron. Like, I don't need, like, Megatron to be, like, really deep. I just need him to be, like, this, like, big, like, embodiment of evil that, like, Optimus Prime has to go out and do battle with. There's, like, this, like, moment in, like, that dumb, like, 80s cartoon that, like, really, like, cemented, like, Megatron for me and, like, my little kid brain. Just, like, man, there's, like, nothing you can do to, like, reason with this guy or, like, negotiate with him. He's just gonna be, like, whatever's, like, the most terrible thing he can do to you, that's what he's gonna do. And we see that here with, like, Saris, when he, like, he revels in like, the victory over his enemy, when he's like, no, I'm gonna devastate this guy's entire life. It's not enough that I killed his entire planet. It's not enough that I've defeated his ship and taken over his ship and I've captured his crew. I'm going to, like, bring down I'm gonna crush his soul and make his hero admit to being a big fraud. The whole reason you built this entire ship, this powerful ship that I am willing to move heaven and earth to come capture, is because this clown over here inspired you, and I'm gonna show you how big of a charlatan he is and just utterly devastate you.
It's when you get to see, I think, you know, Tim Allen, to his credit, does a very good job here.
Yeah.
In how devastated he seems at the moment. You know, what had been a fun thing when they first, you know, when he first met the Thermians and he was like, oh, this is just neat, this is cool. Now it all has turned serious and now he sees the real stakes. And when he's like, says, like, God, I'm so sorry, you know, he, like, really conveys it.
Tim Allen is so good in this. Like, they talk about this scene a lot in the documentary. Apparently, this is the one scene Steven Spielberg was on set for.
Oh.
It shows. Yeah. Holy hell. It shows. This is like, what else has Tim Allen done that's like this guy? Like,
yeah.
I'm sure he's had, like, dramatic roles and stuff I've never seen, but I can't imagine anything being better than this.
No, he's so good in this. And even, like, he has, like, good, more emotional moments in, like, something like the Santa Claus, but nothing like this. Like, and in fact, okay, this is a story they tell. That apparently, like, he got pretty emotional filming this. Mm. And then he went, they got it. He was like, oh, he's like, I'm kind of like, he's like, I want to go back to my dressing room. I, like,
right.
I'm feeling some things. And apparently Alan Rickman was, like, there and went, and he walked away and he went, oh my God, I think he just experienced acting.
But, you know, Tim Allen probably would be the first to admit, like, he was a comedian who learned how to act to be on a TV show. He's not, like, an actor mm-hmm. first. So, and to be told that from, like, Alan Rickman, to, like, make that kind of, like, insulting joke at your expense, that's actually kind of a compliment.
Yeah.
Sure.
No, and I want to point out that Alan Rickman did not make the joke to him. He walked away and he said it to somebody else. Like,
right, right.
But, I mean, what is Alan Rickman ain't going to be like, oh, that really sucked. You know, like, you can't say that. So it's like, okay, how can I, like, acknowledge this was good acting, but still kind of be a jerk about it? So I don't know.
I make a little joke.
I like it. I think that was a good, well played, Mr. Rickman.
And apparently, like, he was immediately back to being, like, goofy with, like, Steven Spielberg. He was like, wait, what's happening now? No. I'm sorry. I just saw Joel's comment about Alan is a drug smuggler first, remember? Forgot about that. Tim Allen, bing.
I didn't know about that. I know that he's, he sounds like he's kind of like a blowhard who, like, doesn't like paying taxes. I don't know what other annoying things about him are out there, but I know he's been up to some stuff.
Tim Allen was, before he was famous, went to jail for being a drug dealer.
That's good stuff. I'm going to have to look into this.
All I knew about Tim Allen was, like, Home Improvement and the Santa Claus movies and this. And then he did some movie called, like, Jungle to Jungle that Dominic Keating is in.
I forgot Dominic Keating is in that. I have seen Jungle to Jungle. It's a very 80s, it's also a very 80s mugshot. He's, like, got a big mustache. And...
Nice.
You know, if he was just selling, like, weed and stuff like that, I'm not going to be too judgy about it. Alan Moore,
it was,
you know, a great writer, sold drugs, too.
I forget, it might have been cocaine.
That sounds about 80s, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was trendy. That was a big deal in the 80s.
So, Father, you were talking about this scene, though, where they get to, like, kind of show some old synergy based on their memories of the show.
We've been talking a lot lately about Star Trek Enterprise, Dave, as we just recently went through season one. People want to check out some of the recent Tex Trek episodes we were covering in season one Enterprise. But one thing that I notice happens a lot is that Archer and Trip, they'll kind of do their kind of, I don't know, their improv deceptions.
Yep.
And we see that. But it is a very, like, I was going to say Shatner Nimoy thing, but a Kirk Spock thing. But you can't help but think of it as like these two scene partners, these two actors on stage, you know, acting out this little, like, two-person performance. But that's what we get with, like, the two of them. And they kind of, like, vent some of, like, their real frustration and, like, yell at each other and play fight. Because, you know, like, they're actors. They know the choreography. And they get actually, like, a little bit of combat skill and get the rest of the crew free. But I like that because, you know, it's one of those things that we see in Star Trek frequently. And it worked well here in the movie.
It's when they start taking back, they start getting back their agency after having it had it entirely robbed by Saris.
It kind of goes back and forth, a few times throughout this third act.
Yeah, we get some exciting ups and downs.
I was mentioning the Super Bowl earlier, unless I cut that out for the podcast people. But if they're wondering what I'm talking about, go watch the YouTube stream. Hit subscribe while you're there, podcast people. But yeah, it is kind of like a football game where like both teams are like scoring a lot because like, the ball is going like back and forth. Because every time they seem to like get like a one up, and you think like Saris is finally done for, he's still standing. That's a very fun, satisfying moment when they throw his minions out into space, and then later you see the bodies like bugs on the windshield on his ship.
Yeah,
it's fitting that he kind of looks like a cockroach because he is hard to kill. Like.
Yeah, that's another good point. I kind of thought of him as more like a reptile man than an insect man, but I guess he has more insect. He's got like antennae and like...
There's definitely reptile there too.
It looks like insect chitin on his armor is kind of like, it's almost like his own bug armor skin.
Their design kind of inspires some of like the Zindi in season four of Enterprise, speaking of
Enterprise. Somebody that was mentioned in the comments, I noticed. This builds to what I think is one of the film's great dramatic moments is, of course, when Quellic dies, essentially, and inspires Dane to have to embody his character as Quellic is dying and take on the actual, you know, kind of warrior ethos for a moment and really honor the person who died believing in him. Really a heart-wrenching scene.
God, he plays both Alan Rickman and the actor playing Quellic play it so well that it's like it's heartbreaking.
And when he delivers, you know, Dane delivers the Grabthar's hammer line, he says it like with total conviction. It's like he's not even acting in the moment. It's like the first time
he said it and like really meant it. Like since he was like on the show, like he's been half-assing it for so many years. But here's the first time he's like I truly believe these words. Like I will avenge you.
I know I was like watching this in the theater and having a great time. I was not expecting to have like tears in my eyes, you know, during the big final action sequence. And that's when I was this is something kind of special.
It's like, you spend so much time with the characters, you're like, oh, they earned this. Like between like both of them, you're like,
and it's a brave thing to do.
Yeah, like
it's bold to try to do something like serious with like these like goofy aliens that make all like these goofy noises and walk around looking all stupid, and then like you want to be all sad when one of them dies. That's a tricky thing to pull off, and it's kind of a risky thing to attempt.
I think that, you know, when you think about how they constructed it so that they ratchet up the kind of drama when Saris captures them and, you know, forces the confession from Nesmith, and you're like, oh, like I'm really being bounced around here. We are hitting some peaks of seriousness, and you kind of never know when there's going to be another serious moment. So there's some real suspense at the end. You know, like, oh, they're not all going to probably die. But at this point, you're like, oh, but people could die. So.
Mm-hmm. And there's so much to what like the main, you know, core of the story, of the themes of the story are, but about fandom and about like performance and like that connection. And it's like the greatest thing like a performer can give a fan or like an enthusiast is just like impactful, like that moment of impact. And what the hell could encapsulate that more than what they came up with here?
I think like it shows like how in real life, like how much like different art can mean to like someone, even if it's like it's not just a silly TV show. It's like a piece of art that like affected a person.
Because it's the fans' reaction. It is Quillick.
Quillick. Yeah,
The Thermians are also fans of the show. They just don't quite realize.
It's
right.
It's Quillick. Yeah, that's what I'm talking about when I'm talking about like the fan and the performer and like the impact. Mm-hmm. But with Quillick here, it's like his reaction. Like when he finally got to hear like the lines in person. Like it would be mm-hmm. like if Leonard Nimoy like held me before I died and said like live long and prosper or something. Like right? it's like if. It feels like his reaction to that is just like, oh my god, I don't care that I'm literally bleeding to death this very second. This is the coolest thing that's like ever happened to me. It's like I understand why, as bizarre as that sounds, I understand why this guy would feel that way.
In a much less dramatic way, I felt this way when it's like a piece of like usually musicals that I know well, but the first time I actually get to see it live, like in a theater, it like hits mm-hmm. me differently. Like the Sound of Music in particular, like there was years and years ago, they do a play in Zirkle Park every year. It's like free. And they did the Sound of Music. And there was like two things that really hit me. And it was like the live, they had her start out. It's on the hill. And they had her start singing like the Sound of Music from the hill behind you. So then she like mm-hmm. came through the audience.
Oh, how cool.
Then they had Captain Von Trapp and the part where he sings Edelweiss Alone. They had him sing it in German.
Mm-hmm.
And it like I was just like, oh my god, like hearing this and like having this moment in person is like affecting me so like so much.
Yeah, again, there's a reason why we talk about these things, and you know,
yeah,
it's not because these things are just throwaway fantasies.
Mm-hmm.
they transport in the Big Rock Man too. Greg Knack comes in and just wrecks some of the bad guys in the hangar, I think.
I feel a little big bag for the Rock Man also floating in space. I don't know that he deserves that.
That is one of my favorite moments, though, is when they do beam them up. When Fred is like, oh, I have a fun idea. And just the way the execution
mischief.
Of that.
Their
digitizer or whatever they call it, like it's like the effect is cool to make it different from the transporter, which is kind of like, you know, slow. It makes like this sound that kind of like calmly mm-hmm. transitions you in as you beam in. This thing's just kind of like it's like Thor and with like his lightning and the Bifrost and like the MCU movies. You're just kind of like zapped in instantly, and there's this like lightning and it's like this big sudden thing. But when you have like Greg Knack show up and all those guys just kind of look up, one of them smoking a cigar, and they're just like, oh yeah, we're that's kind of like the same moment that DeMarco and Nesmith have when they see the chompers. It's just like, well, screw mm-hmm. that, you know, kind of reaction. But you know, they do all kind of get like their big moment in the third act. You know, Guy is like, okay, I'll accept my role as the red shirt. And then Fred is like, maybe you don't have to be the red shirt who dies. Maybe you can be the plucky comedic relief. I think that was a word that we were saying a lot in 99 because of George Lucas's creation of Jar Jar Binks. But you see, I guess Tommy Weber like doesn't do too much. He just kind of has to watch his footage of like piloting the ship, but
I love it. What is he says his catchphrase, and it's not as serious as by Brad Thor's hammer, but he's like, what is it?
Pedal to the metal,
Captain.
Yeah,
and it's like he's actually feeling it, and it's like it is a cool scene.
It's like, speaking of just like random, like the how good the casting is, that his random younger self is Corbin Bleu. It's like, it's very funny to me, and I know Corbin Bleu. Corbin Bleu, most famous probably for, he is in the High School Musical movies, but he has a pretty good, like, stage career now. And so just like, baby Corbin Bleu, what are you doing here? Like,
By the way, the Rock Man, I feel like, were they to ever do one of those occasionally talked about Galaxy Quest spinoffs thing, I think that they could show that they, you know, like some Thermians picked up the Rock Man in space, and like he's kind of
back.
An ally now, and maybe you would occasionally even see him on the ship. Like, I think you could have a little
That
fun
would be
it.
Fun.
I think that one of the reasons why the movie is such like a love letter to fans, why we think of it that way, mm-hmm. is because the fans are part of that third act teamwork element. Yeah. When everyone like has like their moment and their chance to shine, the fans do as well. When Brandon, where they have to call into Brandon for tech support, basically, it's like okay, like none of us actors actually know the layout of the ship, but you know who does? The nerds who watch the shit. So let's call them.
You know, it's so good because I think you know we kind of know tropes and story arcs, mm-hmm. and I was like, oh, I bet you know, maybe I probably in the back of my head, I was thinking, oh, Jason Nesmith will go and apologize to him in the end, and you know, maybe give him a pass to a you know a convention or say, you know, we want you to come out to the set or something like that. But I could not have expected that the fans would be integral to saving their asses. Yeah. And that's so cool.
Apparently there was some studio note that they were like, maybe we should cut that subplot. And the director was like, no, that's the heart of the movie.
Oh,
like,
wow.
It's the fact
that's
that
wild.
The fans. And he was like, that is like, that's so important that it's like, no, the fans help save them.
The other funny thing is that the big death scene that we were just talking about, I guess when they were mm-hmm. shooting that, one of the producers was on set like, oh, we need to hurry up and move on. And they were like, no, we're going to like take our time with this moment here. And then Alan Rickman mm-hmm. was actually like yelling at the line producer, get off the set now. We're trying to work here.
mm-hmm.
But the idea of like, oh yeah, like all of these nerds are like on the internet and on their computers talking to each other, and they have kind of like this hive mind, you know, it is kind of like the Borg yeah. collective. But you know, that was such a more of a thing now than it was back then. But that thing, mm-hmm. what the Star Trek fandom was a bit ahead of the curve on just like connecting online sure. through you know more primitive yeah. ways in 1999 before social media was as big as it is now. But that was certainly in existence then, and I'm sure so many more people watching this movie now can relate to the fandom depicted here.
Oh yeah, I totally relate to that. As like for like different fandoms, it would be funny. Like for multiple friend groups I'm in, if someone like has like a Star Trek thing will come up, people will just like text me or like message me and be like, "Hey, explain this for me real quick." I believe one of my favorites was like once a friend was watching something Star Trek adjacent. And someone was talking about the Q, and he went, is Q his name or his species? And I believe my answer was yes.
Yeah, that's accurate. Like, but I think when you see Brandon's room and how he's like, mm-hmm. he's like in the middle, like building a model. I mean, that was when this movie came out. I was a teenager who built like model mm-hmm. starships. That was I don't know. I felt it was like a very fair depiction of a Trekkie.
Yeah. And a little bit of laughing at, but mostly in a kind of, you know, not a truly cruel way,
the jokes are, like, the joke where he has to go take, like, the trash out is, like, it's just a good joke. Like, it's not at his
expense.
Yeah,
I'm sorry,
like,
but I've been there.
Yeah. And it's, like,
and
not
honestly,
a,
you know,
like,
anybody
oh,
who's
just
even been playing, like, a video game and their mom made him go mm-hmm. take out the trash and you had to pause
yeah.
your game or whatever.
Which is more of a today thing than it would have been then. But, yeah, like, online yeah. gaming, I think, is for sure more of a thing now. Yeah. So.
I like, definitely had things where I'd be, like, or I'd be, like, watching something. I'd be so into it. You need to go do this. But I, even, like, fairly, in the last couple of years, my brother got married a couple years ago. And there was, like, I think season 2 of Picard was coming out with this, and I kept trying to like have a moment during that weekend to just go watch the new episode, and it just kept not happening. And
why
that was me at like 28. Like, and to be fair, I was like, I wasn't trying to do it during the actual wedding, for the record. It was like the weekend or surrounding it, family members kept showing up at my house.
Listen, I won't judge you if it was during the wedding.
Well, honestly, that would have been impossible. They got married at a ranch that with no internet. So,
boo. So we're getting to the big finale, and yeah. and the little secret finale too. Mm-hmm. There's kind of two, really.
The secret finale.
The secret finale is where
is
they
there,
crash
is there
at the convention.
A post-credit scene that I've never
no,
seen.
No, it's
in
when Saris is still alive at the convention at the very end. But, like, first they have to, like, use the Omega 13.
Well, even before that, like, they bomb his ship with the mines. And yeah. He beamed over, so that they got to...
I would say another really, I think, good moment is after the Crushers with the thing doesn't work, so they think they're going to die, and then it just doesn't go off because, oh, yeah, the detonation never happens on the TV show. Why would they build that in? I think it's
right,
such
it always
a
stops
good...
at one.
Yeah, such a good, like, the trope, because there was so many countdown to the destruction of the ship, and it never happens.
That is, like, that's the one joke that kind of bugs me, because that's, like, I mean, that's just more like a general TV trope of, like, the clock always stops at one. That's not really, like, a, I don't know, I kind of, I feel like Star Trek is, like, better than that, than to have, like, the clock always stopping, like, exactly 1 second.
I would say for this, it is fair for them to make jokes that are just TV shows in general, because they at no point do they claim to do it too much.
They don't really abuse it, so it was, but it's a funny enough joke that, like, oh, it didn't even matter that he was gone taking the trash out. But
sometimes a good joke can get by on that.
Yeah. And I would say this, even while it's so Star Trek focused in a lot of ways, at no point does this movie say, like, this is Star Trek. They just say, this is a sci-fi TV show.
Right.
So, yeah, like,
it's clearly
so
more
many
homaging Star Trek than anything. It's like 95% Star Trek and then, like, 5%, like, other media.
Yeah. I would say other media does it so much that I'm like, I'll allow it. Like,
and certainly there's countdowns in Star Trek, so it's in the ballpark. Yeah. The thing where they're dragging the mines, though, that is very much, that's Kirk, you know, in the Mutara Nebula, or, you know, various, you know, prefix code Kirk. That's a classic Trek
It was more of the actors. It was more of like, hey, it doesn't take a great actor to recognize a bad actor. Like, I think that I think that in this game of chicken, you know, you'll blink first. He's like, oh, do you realize you're going up against a general?
Yeah, it's a great scene. This movie actually has a lot of, like, it's very crowd pleasy, and what I would say is the best way. You know, I don't feel like it's goofy pandering. Just that they give you, like, all of these really satisfying, you know, kind of finales at the end, and Saris's end is a good one. He gets his ass blown to pieces, and he deserves it.
Well, he gets disintegrated on the planet.
That's true.
Yeah.
But before that, I think
back to Earth with them, which is, like, impressive.
I think the moment of him actually getting his just desserts, though, is when Mathazar beats him up with his cane or walking stick or whatever. Because he had been tortured by him. And Mathazar is such, like, a, he's so pure.
Right.
Like, you can't imagine him, like, actually being, like, hateful against, like, Saris, but it's still satisfying as all hell just, like, watch him just, like, whack the shit out of Saris and knock him out. The reveal of the Omega 13 is, like, this time travel device, but you can only use it one time and only for 13 seconds, so it's just good enough to redeem one single mistake. I was like, oh, that's a neat sci-fi idea. That's worthy of having, like, this big reveal at the very end of the movie.
They had, like, worked it in really well earlier, where it, like, it became clear, like, it's probably gonna come back, but not in a super obvious way.
Yeah.
Like, it felt really natural when, like, they asked, like, the fan, hey, what do you think this is?
Right. And they, like, he gets into, like, for a second. Fan spec stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, and thematically it fits, is because, like, what you know, what is this movie about but, like, Jason Nesmith trying to correct his own mistakes, you know, recognizing that he's a flawed person and trying to be better. And so the fact that this device is something to do exactly that, you know, in a very action way at the very end, but, you know, it fits the theme.
Mm-hmm. And it allows them to do that, allows for, like, a really dark moment where, like, you see most of them die.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, but I love that. I love, like, time travel. I just love
that trope.
I love that moment in a movie where you can just be like, oh my god, I have no idea what the hell is going on. My entire world is turned upside down. What's going to happen next?
And I think when a movie, like, when it hasn't had a lot of those moments, so when it does happen, you're like, whoa, what?
Yeah.
That's allowed to happen in this? It's funny, because the other big one I can think of is, like, the last thing in the Twilight movie, where they do a flash that does not happen in the book and make you think all the characters die. And it is insane.
Oh, right. I know of this, even though I have not seen the movie. I've seen a glimpse of that.
I like the idea of doing that, though. I like that a lot.
Firefly, I think, after a notable character death, I'm sorry, in Serenity, the movie that ended Firefly, has a notable character death, and then what looks like it may be several more coming up. And you're like, oh shit, they're really
spoilers.
Do
they all die,
and things play out interestingly. But, you know, at that point, every fan's heart was, like, in their throat, because you don't know. So
yeah,
and so then we finally the protector crashes back at the convention on Earth, somehow not killing people, but it looks cool.
Yeah, I mean, there's gonna be a lot of like insurance claims, you know, like it. It knocked out a bunch of cars in the parking lot and then and half of a building.
Actually, no wonder he thought of Marty McFly. Like, this is a very, like, Back to the Future shot of it going over Justin Long's head.
It's almost like I kind of don't want there to ever be a sequel to this, because I don't want to deal with, like, them probably explaining, not. Like, what do we do with, like, this big spaceship that crashed here? But it is so cool. It's just, like, someone who, like, goes to conventions and stuff. Imagine if you were at a convention and, like, all the actors, like, showed up late, but then when they did arrive, like, they crashed, like, a ship into the building and then, like, came off onto stage and disintegrated an alien in front of all of us. Like, that would be the coolest con I've ever been to, ever.
Yeah, it's great. I like that it exists in this heightened reality, mm-hmm. where, you know, in reality, you know, in the real, real world, if that happened, there'd be so much damage and destruction, you'd be like, know that this was something not planned, and everybody would be running in terror. But in the movie's heightened reality, they can think, it's staged.
They do run in terror a little bit. At the beginning, they're all like, what the fuck, and ran. Like,
yes.
When I was, like, going over my notes and taking, like, screenshots of this movie and getting everything ready to do the show last night when I was getting ready for today, for whatever reason, when I saw, like, the image of, like, all of them, like, holding hands on stage mm-hmm. and, like, taking a bow, like, I just, like, erupted and just, like, started crying, just, like, sitting here just, like, looking at it. Like, I feel like I had an emotional experience just, like, being so, like, looking at this movie, like, so closely, and just, like, that fandom lifestyle is such, like, a big part of just, like, how I live every day. And just, I guess, as someone who is never, like, I was never, like, in love with this movie. It was never, like, a movie, like, that I owned, like, a physical copy of, or just, like, mm-hmm. watched a billion times. Like,
have a physical copy of it.
Yeah, so many things that I'm a fan of, I just, like really, like, obsess over and just, like, learn every little thing about. And I've always, like, respected this movie, but I've never had that. But it's like, I don't know. It really is just like a work of art. It really is, like, it's so good. It's so ambitious, mm-hmm. and is able to, like, pull off its ambitions. And yet it doesn't feel like, you know, like this big, you know, cocky revolutionary thing. It doesn't reinvent the wheel. It's just good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sometimes there's movies like that. I think that, like, I'm going to say The Princess Bride is, like, one of the most special movies ever invented, I think. But mm-hmm. I often hear people kind of talk about this in similar tones, where it's, like, almost everybody likes it, almost everybody finds it funny and sweet and heartwarming.
Those movies, they're so unique in that, and I think part of it is that it feels like it could be way more cynical, and it's not.
Right, but you know what's kind of clever about this? They both have veneers of cynicism. You know, mm-hmm. we have Wesley saying, you know, anyone who tells you the world's, a fair place is selling you something or whatever. Yeah. And in this, we have a lot of cynicism about acting and backstabbing among actors early on. And then they move to this much more heartfelt, sincere place by the end.
Yeah.
And they take you along with that for that ride.
I think that's why it works. I think that mm-hmm. because it acknowledges the cynicism of reality, it doesn't feel like it's, you know, like pie in the sky. This is we can have this happy ending and make believe, but it's all, you know, imaginary. Like it doesn't, like I said so many times as we discussed this, like, so much of this movie rings true, mm-hmm. and I think that that's, like, a huge part of it.
It's the end with them all holding hands. It's like, one, they earned it because, like, you're like, oh, because you saw the journey. But it reminds me of, like, when you see the Star Trek cast, particularly the TNG cast together, you're like, oh, they all really like each other.
Well, you know, that sort of leads into the finale here. But I want to say one more thing. When they're holding hands, of course, Nesmith is initially, he and, like, maybe Gwyn are up there, but he calls the rest of the crew up. It's super important.
Yeah.
He's got to be the one for thematically and for the story to really have resonance. He calls them up there to stand as his equal in that moment.
It reminds me, I don't know, I always, every time, because I was involved in theater, I always, like, I love seeing the bows.
Yeah.
And it reminds me of the moment when, like, they all hold hands at the end, and they also, in theater, they, like, also will, like, motion to, like, the conductor and the person doing the lights to, like, that, like, that's why when they're holding their hands up, that's what they're doing. They're, like, acknowledging the, like, behind the scenes people.
I did not know that. That's cool.
And I don't know, it's always, like, a really sweet moment, and I like that it acknowledges that, like, art in general, especially movies and TV and theater, are, like, it's a group effort. It's not just, like, one person doing it.
Yeah. And you could say that's a big part of the theme of this movie, and even mm-hmm. like, you need the audience too. You know, you're not really putting on a show unless someone's watching it.
Definitely.
their final bit is that they get what would be kind of their TNG or whatever.
Yeah, the journey continues. Yeah. Galaxy yes. Quest, the journey continues. Yeah.
Another, you know, in its way, this is a little bit like Lord of the Rings. There's like several different endings. Ceres is defeated a couple times. They take the bow. They get the new show. And they're all satisfying. They're all good.
Yeah. And instead of being over 3 hours, it's under 2 hours. So it's a much more efficient filmmaking.
To see the thing of how they convince the studio, like, no, you have to have Guy. The random extra, you have to have Guy.
But that makes it more of a Star Trek thing, because then a security officer like came back to life. Yeah. So he kind of becomes like a Tasha Yar type guy.
Yeah. His cheesy like kind of finger guns to the audience is so good.
It's so good. Do we think this is supposed to be the Star Trek trope of someone coming back to the life, or the Star Trek trope of just reusing the same actors and hoping no one will
notice? They could have just, like, recast them as, like, a different character. But they both would have been, like, insecurity, so it could have been a resurrected dude.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mentioned a little bit a second ago about, like, a sequel to this, but there has been, you know, a lot over the years, there has been, like, different times they've talked about either doing it as a movie or as a TV show. I know that there was a comic at one point, and it sounded like they were going to do it at one point in time right before Alan Rickman died. They didn't know that he was sick.
No, I think Alan Rickman was very private about his health struggles, which is fair.
I listened to an interview with the director, Dean Pariseau. That's how I know the T is silent. But he was saying how Alan Rickman had told them, like, you know, it's going to be hard for me to work, but, you know, if this is what you're using me for, then yes, I am very excited to do this. Let's do it. Mm-hmm. Well, but then like he died like right after they had that conversation, and he said like the idea that they had needed his character, and that just kind of killed the entire idea.
They would be able to do it without something. Him. There's like another script in the works, which that was a couple years, so I could see them having to completely rewrite the whole idea because one of the lead actors just being gone.
Yeah, but I think that's your story opportunity there. I think like, oh yeah, we did the sequel show and it ran for a long time and everyone loved it. And then like, oh no, our castmate died and now like we don't know what to do.
You know, on one level, Fathery, I think, you know, this is a perfect kind of movie. I don't, you know, like what could it do but be somewhat less perfect or even like not bad? Like it could be bad. And that would be a heartbreaker.
The most correct stance. That's where my allegiance lies.
It's funny that I'm like, I'm so worried they'd mess it up, but I was like, I still like would love to see it.
I can picture a version that works. I can imagine it happening,
It's a long shot.
Glad they didn't do it right after Alan Rickman like passed away, because I feel like that can be really tricky. But you have to do something like do not envy this. Like any TV show, especially comedies, where they have to deal with like an actor suddenly passing away is like, oof. It's hard. And so I think
that's life in general. Yeah. Like, you know, no matter what job you have, your coworker could up and die and just turn everything upsy-turvy.
But I think it's been long enough where you could still like do a nice tribute, but it won't be like as raw, which would be nice.
If they had some quality people working on it, I would probably get enthused for it, even knowing that it probably couldn't live up.
I mean, I like this. If Dean Pariseau wanted to do it, but he did. Mm-hmm. He did Bill and Ted Face the Music. So, however you feel about like, if you think Bill and Ted 3 is a worthy sequel, then I guess like
I think it's fun. Then
that's approval for Galaxy Quest 2.
When I was looking at like what else he had worked on, or as he did the Monk pilot, and I was like, oh, he must really get along with Tony Shalhoub.
I wanted to be a show where they can do different plots and things like that. But, you know, not like a show that runs forever, just, you know, 2-3 seasons or something.
If they
like
do
that.
It as a show, I'm less likely to watch it, so I'd rather it be a movie.
Why would you be less likely to watch it?
Just, I don't watch as many TV shows.
The time commitment and all that? That's fair.
Hey, right, if the show comes out when there's no Star Trek coming out, you could cover it.
Yeah. If we run out of old Star Trek. But speaking of which, next week we won't have... We won't have any new Star Trek Discovery, and Prodigy won't be here just yet. However, Dave and I will be talking to Doug Drexler, Oscar Award winner Doug Drexler. He's worked in a lot of Star Trek going all the way back to, well, even before TNG. He did like some fan stuff in the 70s. He was out there, he was working before they were paying him to work in Star Trek. But yeah, we're going to talk
to him.
That's
what they like best.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. But he didn't design the Enterprise for free for Star Trek Enterprise. But we'll talk to him about that, designing the NX-01. He's really involved
Good
with the foundations
him. Get
of
money.
That show. But yeah, he's very involved with the franchise. He glued Michael Dorn's Klingon makeup onto his face and on TNG. He worked in DS9, and he did a lot of stuff in Star Trek Picard season 3 last year. So it should be a lot of fun.
That's a big thing. I'm very excited.
Yeah, so please come check that out. We will be live Friday at 7 p.m. And like I mentioned before, we'll have coverage of new Star Trek when it does return later in the year. We'll bring back the Thursday First Reactions with Rachel for the new Discovery episode starting April 4th. It's First Contact Eve.
Hell yeah.
So...
I want to
start celebrating that.
Yeah, so we'll have
Let's give First Contact gifts on First Contact Eve.
We'll bust out the tequila and First Contact Day salmon.
Yeah, that's very fitting.
Yeah,
judging by what happens in the movie First Contact, I believe that is him getting drunk and running away.
Like, yeah, we'll all get drunk and run away. until then, as always. Live long and prosper, y'all.
Listen to the Text Trek podcast through Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or at text-trek.com. Like us on Facebook at facebook.com/text-trek. And follow Fathery on Twitter at TXTrek. Please support us by liking our videos and subscribing to our channel on YouTube. Thank you and take care.